broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today we're featuring columnist Amity Schlaes, who writes on the economy and politics and draws parallels between the Great Depression and today's floundering economy.
I want to welcome you back and take this time to introduce our speaker today. Our guest today is a distinguished writer on economic themes whose commentary has appeared in an amazing variety of publications such as the Financial Times, of course, the Wall Street Journal, the New Yorker, the American Spectator, Forbes, and National Review. And that's just for openers. Unless I overlook Indianapolis, it's also appeared in the Indianapolis Star on the editorial opinion pages. And of course, I hope you've heard her contributions to public radio's Marketplace program. Amity Schlaes is a woman of many titles. She writes a syndicated column for Bloomberg News. She soon will be the director of economic growth for the new Bush Institute. She currently teaches in the MBA program, a course on economics of the Great Depression at the Stern School at NYU. She is a magna cum laude graduate of Yale University. She's won numerous awards, including one of my favorite titles, the Deadline Club Citation for opinion writing, and the 2009 Hayek Prize awarded by the Manhattan Institute. And next year, her new book on Calvin Coolidge will be published. To most of you, she's probably best known for her 2007 book titled The Forgotten Man, A New History of the Great Depression. In it, she advances the thesis that both presidents, Herbert Hoover and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, promoted economic policies that prolonged the Depression. Is it possible there are corollaries to here today that may apply? As you might imagine, both the Depression hypothesis and the one I just mentioned have stimulated some controversy among economists. And frankly, as having an economics department, I enjoy controversy among economists. It is a true pleasure to introduce, of course, a nationally and internationally recognized journalist and a molder of public opinion. Please welcome all of you, Amity Schlaes.
Thank you for this time. Thank you, Chancellor. It's an honor to be here and to meet with you. As the Chancellor mentioned, my forthcoming book is about Calvin Coolidge, and you didn't know it, but Calvin Coolidge was also a Hoosier in spirit. There's much of the Midwest in Coolidge, I'm discovering as I get to know him. He's only nominally from Vermont. I'm from Chicago myself. This is a serious group. In a state that has shown leadership in the area of economic recovery. We are watching you, we follow you, and I just want to mention that on a lot of fronts, whether it has to do with schools or growth or restructuring and reviving your downtown area, the nation is watching you and admiring you. I want to say that. You heard I was introduced as a Depression author. Anyone who turns to the Great Depression of the 1930s turns not only, of course, to the economy, but also to the culture. The culture tells you things about an economy that data points cannot. It matters, for example, that the Philco radios that were popular in those years were shaped like altars or cathedrals. So when President Roosevelt spoke out of them, his economic dictates, they sounded strong, they sounded divine. It was ex cathedra to hear the radio fireside chats of the president. The 1930s were the period when something else came into our living rooms, the Monopoly board game. The man who laid out the board game, and I'm talking about the game, Charles Darrow, business story, couldn't introduce manufacturers in the game. He took it to Parker Brothers, who actually turned Monopoly down as a commercial prospect, noting that it found 52 design flaws in the game. But Darrow entrepreneurially made his own copies of the game, and in the middle of the 30s, Parker Brothers did buy it, and it did become popular, wildly popular in the Roosevelt years as well. So you want to imagine people sitting in the 1930s at their card tables playing Monopoly before they switch on the cathedral-shaped radio to hear the president deliver a fireside chat. By 1935, Monopoly was so important that the New York Times was writing, leading all other board games is the season craze Monopoly, the game of real estate. Today, I'm going to talk about the economy then, the Great Depression, and now in the context of that board game. Recoveries make a choice. Ours is not sure it wants to come back. Maybe it's choosing to stay away. We don't even know where recovery comes from always. Here, there. But there are some very real similarities between then and now, and I'll try to draw them out in a way that helps us to think about how we do business, how we assess specifically the business climate, and how we can get the recovery, the full recovery that we long for. It starts with the Monopoly Board. Again, when I say monopoly, don't think of antitrust law. Think of a family in the living room. You know the game. More luck and less skill is involved than some of the games like Settlers that some younger people here may play. Still in Monopoly, there's a strategy. You're trying to build yourself a certain existence with those houses. Maybe get a hotel, and when you do and the rent revenue goes up, you pat yourself on the back and say, I'm compounding. The Monopoly board, you have the set figures, the rich people, the top hat token. Maybe you don't like the top hat because you think he's arrogant, or maybe you take the top hat for good luck because you want to become the top hat. Either way, Americans seem to have an abiding interest in the top hat token. That's one of the few that stayed in the game in all the years that it has been sold, not switched out. Your willingness to play that game depends on a few things. Getting a predictable number of pay income tax cards, not too many. You can handle the income tax blows because you know the amount on the card and you know how many there are in the deck. It's also a factor for you that the number of go-to-jail cards might be predictable. Chance cards, you've reckoned that out, perhaps. In other words, you have to have some certainty of the rules of the game, that you own what you own, that the risks to your property that you're acquiring can be reckoned. What else matters in Monopoly? The temperament of the bank. Shouldn't. There's a fixed supply of Monopoly money. That's just supposed to be an automatic job. Ideally, the bank follows those rules and allows himself little or no discretion. But we all have had the experience of sitting down at the table to discover a bank who overreaches. Players know what they require of a bank. The bank doesn't have to be perfect. The bank just has to be what? Not too bad. Not too bad. If the bank is too unpredictable, too discretionary, too jumpy, you know what happens. The player walks away from the board. No game. So, when it comes to the Great Depression, we know the traditional narrative. The crash generated a kind of economic Katrina. One in four was unemployed. The crisis at first, initially, was monetary, credit, international, all those factors, consumer confidence, tariffs, some combo of that. The terrible thing about the Great Depression was the duration of it. unemployment that was double-digit for more than a decade, averaging in the mid-teens, in fact, higher than ours. The second traditional story we hear about the Great Depression is that it was mysterious, topic for PhDs only, great brains were needed to explain it, mine's a standard deviation or two farther out than ours. That's why Franklin Roosevelt's advisory group was called the Brains Trust. They had a lot of credentials. You've heard the name Felix Frankfurter, Francis Perkins, Stuart Chase, Adolf Burley, expert in governance, George Warren. The mystery of the Depression, we were taught, had something to do with the shortage of money that only a prince of the economics kingdom could understand. Corollaries in that period in the New Deal, government knew better than big business. Big business knew better than small business. The small player at that monopoly board, he was almost irrelevant to the narrative. A couple other presumptions we have about that depression. One is that cleaning up Wall Street was important, that getting rid of white-collar criminals, the creation of the SEC was important. Franklin Roosevelt was a tease. He, in fact, had a joke. He said his wealthy critics reminded him of this joke. The joke is about a man wearing a tuxedo and top hat who falls into the water and nearly drowns and is saved by you from drowning. You pull him back to shore, after which, instead of saying thank you, this rich man starts complaining he lost his top hat and it's your fault. To him, to Roosevelt, the wealthy were ingrates. In that period, finally, we were taught that the great labor law, the Wagner Act, was a good thing, that it made our lives better, and that the tempo of change, that lots of change from government, not necessarily predictable, was good, that action was crucial no matter of what quality. Somebody had to do something. That's what we hear about the Depression in 1933. The humorist Will Rogers tried to explain about Roosevelt and doing something, and he said, if Roosevelt burned down the Capitol, we would cheer and say, well, at least he got a fire started anyhow. The country would die if there weren't perpetual action. So that's the official version, or you put it in our monopoly terms. In the 1930s, America was failing because we had no bank. There was nobody to hand out the money. We had too many top hats lording it over the rest, trying to establish a plutocracy monopoly. And we needed a strong credentialed bank to set it right, and Roosevelt materialized, the New Deal materialized to be that bank. But when I went to research the period for the Forgotten Man book, and I want to mention we're making this book now in the cartoon version for Spanish, because we want to share it, I did find a different story, a different series of events. It starts the same, the early part of the Depression, the years upon which the economists have focused, including Chairman Bernanke. By the way, you know that the Fed chairman is the world's leading expert in the Great Depression. Was an economic Katrina, the early 30s, there was the monetary, there was a credit, there was the question of unit banking, very important in this region. Were the banks part of the problem, the way we structured them through our state law and so on? This is all well studied by our forerunners. But the rest of the evidence that I encountered looking at this period does contradict the narrative I just told you. After 2 or 3 years of research, I discerned one big theme. Government made it worse. Herbert Hoover was too unpredictable, a Republican, and too active, far more active than the stereotypes suggest. He did damage. Roosevelt and his New Deal, in turn, continued to impede the recovery. In the 30s, especially the later half of the 30s, which is rarely studied, the New Deal was a kind of calculus of frustration because it was an always recovering but never recovered economy. How did the government do the damage? A couple ways. One was by patronizing. We talked about credentials, the arrogance of planning, the arrogance of credentialism, telling small business you know what's going on and small business doesn't, and you the government, should be listened to heeded, that contracts down there don't matter. What matters is up here, the big deals by the Wall Street players sometimes or by the government. The centerpiece of the New Deal in the first 100 days was an elaborate machine called the National Recovery Administration. You've heard that, those letters, NRA, to get the economy going. The NRA goal was more ambitious than, say, our recent healthcare legislation. The government was supposed to join hands with big business to run the economy. So you want to imagine a multi-sector thing with codes and some self-governance. And what were the theories? Well, they weren't intuitive. What were the theories behind it? One, prices had to be pushed up to make recovery possible. That was one of the big theories of the New Deal. Competition had to be stopped because it was a race to the bottom and slowed, impeded recovery. Big firms were too big to fail. They had to be saved, otherwise you couldn't get recovery. That was another theory of the New Deal in this period. Why? They represented the economy of scale. There was a big romance with the concept of bigger is better, the technocrat, and they were more efficient, so they would get to recovery faster. And consumer choice, well, that was bad because it was inefficient. The consumer took a long time picking which flavor latte he was going to have, and so we got to recovery slower. The absurdity of these assertions was overlooked, or supposed to be, because the assertions came from great credentialed minds. One business that sensed the rules were counterproductive spoke up, even though they were afraid. It was the Schechters, a tiny group of immigrants, kosher butchers in Brooklyn, New York, who were, in fact, prosecuted for violating NRA rules. And I want to read to you from a courtroom scene where they testified, so you can get a feel of the conversation, the economic conversation, really, in the United States in the 1930s. On the one side, you have the lawyer, Walter Lyman Rice. He's from government, of course, and a graduate of Harvard Law School, in fact, later represented Alcoa. And on the other hand, you have the small man from the chicken trade who violated all the rules of the government. His name was Louis Spatz. He was a colleague of the Schechters. And he's afraid of going to jail for doing things he did. So Spatz is trying to defend himself, and he barely speaks English. You have that factor as well. And the prosecutor isn't letting him defend himself, even though Spatz is not quite wrong in what he's saying, so you'll hear it. So I'm going to read it to you. So prosecution, Mr. Rice, you've told me all this, but you do not claim to be an expert. Spatz, no. You're not an expert on the competitive practices in the live poultry industry. Spatz, I would want to get paid if I were an expert. Fighting back a little bit. You are not an expert. And then Spatz, the classic rebuttal, I am experienced but not an expert. You have not studied agricultural economics, so how can you know how your market works? No, sir. Or any sort of economics. No, sir. What is your education? Very little. None at all? Very little. At this point, the everyman, Mr. Spatz, kind of pulls himself together to fight back. So prosecution says, and you would not endeavor to explain economic consequences of competitive practices. Spatz, in my business, I am the best economist. What is that? Oh, in my business, I am the best economizer. Spatz isn't sure if he used the right word. You are the best economizer? Yes, without figuring, without arithmetic. Don't like arithmetic. I wish to have that word spelled in the minutes just as he stated it, i.e., the prosecutor is mocking the education, the presentation of Spatz. Spatz, I do not know how to spell. Why does the dialogue matter? Because, in fact, little businesses like that poultry business then and now are the natural drivers of recovery, and they weren't being allowed to do that driving to accumulate the wealth to get to the sweet spot of sliding a house or a hotel of their property onto the square. They were being sidelined. Mr. Spatz was right. He had to have low prices, or his competitor would beat him and he would shut down. But there was no room in the prosecutorial culture to acknowledge that. Another feature of the period, we can't neglect it, is the monetary aspect of the New Deal. Scholars have been up and down on this story, and we've agreed there wasn't enough money in the early 30s. Whether you call it credit shortage, deflation, something like that, fair enough. good. President Roosevelt understood that. He understood there needed to be more money. There was no problem with that understanding, but what turned out to be problematic was the discretionary way he set about rectifying the problem of not enough money. They tried all kinds of different ways to put money in the system, and it was kind of up to the chief executive. There's a wonderful scene where Henry Morgenthau, who was Roosevelt's advisor and would later become Treasury Secretary, describes Roosevelt's effort to put money in the economy. Roosevelt worked, you know that he had his health challenge and he worked from bed in the morning. So you want to imagine President Roosevelt with lots of advisors around his bed trying to drive up the gold price by buying with federal money. So he's had his egg, he hasn't yet had his cigarette, and people are there and they're giving him counsel. And he says day to day what the price must be of gold and how the federal government will set it. And he said, let it go up this day 21 cents. They write it down, 21, 21, bye. And someone asked, why 21 cents today in 1933 in this almost fall day? Well, said the president, because it's 7 times 3, and 3 is a lucky number. Morgenthau goes back to his room, and we're just drawing this now for the cartoon book, and he writes in his diary, if anyone knew how we set the gold price, they would be frightened. And the markets were frightened, not because they disapproved of the effort to introduce money into the economy, but because they were appalled at the discretionary aspect, the style, that it was just up to one person, his mood. The rally, the stock rally, halted in its tracks. The other areas are important, too, the faith that cleaning up Wall Street would bring recovery. When you look at the period, you see corruption. There were people who deserved to go to jail around the crisis of the New Deal, 29. But there was also damage from the prosecutorial culture that built up. Remember, their rhetoric was much harsher than ours. Roosevelt spoke of princes of property, of making markets and men his subjects, that he would be their master if he won re-election. There was an inaugural address that no modern politician would say into the teleprompter now, whatever party. Roosevelt said he sought in government to seek an instrument of unimagined power to do all kinds of policy and fashion a higher order of things. This caused business to freeze. Didn't know where the government's going to go. Wait it out. Sit it out. Roosevelt, in turn, became angry. He became petulant, and he called them capital strikers, and that's what they were. They were sitting out the round, sitting out the game. The capital strikers mattered. They matter now. They are the ones who play to kill. They are the ones who innovate, who teach us all how to do business. The one who's at the monopoly board who really does take it seriously instead of the rest of us who are there for the company of the other players. Those key people began to sit it out, not just Schechters, but up and down, including, by the way, an innovator from Indiana, Wendell Willkie, who was suffering a broader version of the Schechter story with his struggle to save Commonwealth and Southern, the utility companies. Taxes were important. They created a sort of Voldemort of a tax, the undistributed profits tax. The idea was to force companies who were sitting on cash to disgorge the money to get the economy going. The companies didn't want to, so they taxed the essence of companies. They ate away their soul, maybe more like Dementors than Voldemort, but something that very much intruded on a business culture, because if you didn't disgorge your money on labor, on something else, in dividends, you lost it to the federal government. In the later 30s, a banker, Leonard Ayers of Cleveland Trust, maybe you've worked with the descendants of that bank, pointed out in the Times that the result was that year in, year out, companies were scared and they weren't making money. For nearly a decade now, the great majority of corporations, he wrote in the later 30s, weren't seeing profits. Sounds familiar. I want to mention one last thing regarding big labor and the romance of the Wagner Act. The labor law we have right now is a little neutered kitty cat compared to the labor law they had with a big tiger. And when the Wagner Act came out, it wasn't sure what was allowed. It wasn't clear whether occupation of property, the sit-down strike right here in Indiana, Bendix, was legal or not. It wasn't clear that companies could pay workers anywhere near what they liked. The White House was behind John L. Lewis and so on. And that, too, is a factor. You see an anomalous feature if you look at a graph of wages in the 20th century. You will see that in the Great Depression period, in the later 30s, wages were above trend relative to the century and relative to productivity gains. Wow. They had 15% unemployment and they're paying wages above trend. What's that about? That was the pressure of the Wagner Act. If you think on a cultural level, you've all heard the phrases about the 1930s, it was all right if you had a job, right? Nice work if you can get it. That song first became popular, was written and produced in the later 30s. There became a division because of that high labor price. Those who had jobs did real well, but a lot of people didn't have jobs. Hiring wasn't happening. We said recoveries make a choice. That recovery chose to stay away. 35, 36, 37, 38. The rally of the early years fizzled. In short, the problem of the great game board of the 1930s was not that there was no bank. It was that there was too much bank in the form of the federal government, and that the bank was worse than not too bad. The bank was terrible. It fooled around with the money. It was too aggressive. It was arbitrary. It ignored the importance of stability. It had a very broad range of activity. And it made itself the most powerful player. It shoved everyone else aside so that it might monopolize. I mentioned Wendell Willkie. In fact, I'm going to Rushville to tape with C-SPAN about him because he was the head of this power company, Commonwealth and Southern, that aimed to light up the South until it ran into competition with the government in the form of the Tennessee Valley Authority. And Wendell was a Democrat, but he became angrier and angrier as he saw his shareholder value, his company, its future, his employees crushed by the TVA. And he said, the New Deal is a little bedtime story that's being told to us, but we have to question it and say, well, you know, we too have authority, the authority of business. We can speak up and present another story. It's not hard to see today's troubles in what I just told you, some repeat, some aspect, the arrogance up top, whether it was the preceding administration or the current administration when it comes to bailouts. The Wall Street protesters are right in one aspect. The bailouts were wrong. That's very, very, that if we save the big companies, everything will be all right and the rest of you too. The idea that if leaders have enough credentials, they have to be right. The more credentials alone don't necessarily do it as much as we respect them. The idea that we use our recovery as a pretext for other reform, that a crisis can't be wasted. They had Rahm Emanuels in the 1930s. The health insurance reform is parallel to the Rahm Emanuels, Rex Tugwell. That was the parallel character. They had their parallels to healthcare. The healthcare is the example now. It's not really about recovery, but somehow it got through. The union issue is important as well because unions can slow up recovery. The issue of whether you're a right-to-work state or not matters to your growth. It will increase your GDP in this state if you are a right-to-work state. Disregard, finally, for the individual business experience. What happens to a small firm when the auto deal up top in Michigan is arranged by the government? That disregard for the important characters who are the partners in the contracts, whether they're suppliers or people who own bonds, creditors. Final similarity, monetary. That's the one that preoccupies us. Again, Chairman Bernanke is very educated. What he's doing doesn't sound wrong, but it's the arbitrary aspect, whether it's Operation Twist, QE1, QE2, or QE3 forthcoming. That's the problem that makes us all freeze up. Policy uncertainty. I don't see it all as dark. I have a lot of hope, because remember, vis-a-vis monopoly, what we said at the beginning, the game doesn't have to be perfect for you want to play in it. It just has to be not too bad. And growth isn't merely about animal spirits. It's about enterprise, and there's a lot of enterprise pent up, especially among our young people, that's been waiting for a few years now to get in the game, and they will get in the game as long as we make it not perfect, just not too bad for them. But what does have to change is a basic respect for the entrepreneur, the states, the towns, what we're doing here from Washington, the man who wants the right to his monopoly money, his dollar assured, so it isn't just junk like monopoly money. A recovery doesn't come back to us, doesn't make that choice because of reform from the top. It comes back right there on the board when we buy one house or one hotel at a time. Thank you very much.
As a reminder, questions are welcome up here. Otherwise, I will make them up. You're welcome to tweet them, and they'll bring them up to us. And let me start. The tweet is right here on the front, at Economic Club Inn. Let me start with a question that you set up nicely in the last part of your remarks, having commented that bailouts were wrong, and you mentioned specifically the car companies, fits with this question. I won't ask you if you disagree with the notion that the government should try and stimulate the economy by pumping more money into private hands. It sounds like the answer is yes. I guess the question then becomes the last part, which should we just let companies fail? What should be the strategy in a context like the auto industry?
In a context like the auto industry, the answer is buyout. You buy out. You grandfather and buy out the people who are there to the extent that you can, because they're locked into an industry, the senior workers, they can't get out of. But you pour your capital towards education for the younger ones. Rather than keep the business alive, you devote the capital that you were currently using to keep the business alive, to tell ourselves they're going concerned, to education. You know, if every child of, and you know this better than I do, if every child of every one of these workers got free college at the school he wanted to go to, that would be a big, important give to those families, too. So I think we all have to refocus ourselves towards the people under 40 and be sure that they can go into any business, not just autos, not just auto supply, and that we've prepared them for that way better than we're preparing them. Even giving them a nest egg pension is better than keeping the big ones alive.
Thank you. You've generated a lot of interest here.
Let's have some criticism, right?
And there are some specific questions, let me ask, that several come together with what are the 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 steps that should be taken right now to stimulate the economy, improve our current circumstance, and a nice side note to it, especially in the context of gridlock in Washington since 2009.
But I think one is you kind of drop the word stimulus. It's a bad word. You don't get much outcome from it, stimulus. Sticking to a metaphor, we want to make the rules of playing the economic game less discretionary and clearer. So you clear out the bad provisions of Dodd-Frank. Democrats agree with some of that. Every law has one or two terrible pieces. I was just looking at the ERISA law and what it did with the prudent man rule in the 1970s. It made it impossible to responsibly invest money in venture capital firms like Apple. And when they changed the prudent man rule in the ERISA law, everyone who wanted to invest in companies like Apple was able to, and Mr. Jobs was able to find that money to become the man we're mourning today. That was a technical change to a labor-regulated law about pension that meant the money that poured into firms, there was no money pouring into firms like that in 1977. When they changed that little rule, Democrats, not, you know, could be either party, all of a sudden portfolio companies, big companies, you know, pension companies were able to confidently pick and choose and invest in some little venture capital firms, and some of them did indeed turn out to be big stock market winners like Apple. So you look at the rules you have and you pick out the worst parts of them and you be frank about that and you get rid of those really damaging parts. Not all of Dodd-Frank is bad. Not all of Sarbanes-Oxley is bad. Even, I think, you know, the Volcker rule, not all of it's bad. The second thing, though, is you systematically make the work of these new agencies less discretionary. It should not be about who you know, who you went to school with, and what your regulator says on a certain day. So more towards rules, less towards people and calls and appointments. At the Fed, and I just mentioned one other thing, at the Fed, it currently has a muddy mandate that includes economic growth. The Fed This mandate is way too big. It should be just about money and keeping money stable. That's a law that could be changed that you need, that's hard legislatively to get through. It should not be Chairman Bernanke's job to manage our growth. It should be just the job, confine it to the money. So there's a big, big change. And I would say, healthcare the same. The more you could pull it back, the better, just because all by itself it generates incredible uncertainty about reemploying and employment. So, and that's been, if I have a gut number, I'd say the economy would be growing 25 points, a quarter of a percent faster, maybe 0.5% faster, if we didn't have that overhang of the healthcare law and what it might cost us as firms.
Here are two questions that are disagreeing with you. Wages have been cut, very little labor power, no economic recovery. Why? And a Twitter person who asked right to your recent comment, might health insurance reform help small businesses expand by helping insure the uninsured? So take your choice.
Let's stick with the health insurance. I don't have a very good memory, so I'm going to start with the health insurance working backwards. In the short term, a small business is helped if the federal government takes over its health insurance responsibility. In the medium and long term, it's hurt because it has to pay the taxes to cover that. You're going to pay for it either way if we have a national expectation that health insurance is paid for by somebody other than the person. So who are you selling to? What are your taxes going to be? Is it a lie that they're telling you now, because it is close to that, that this won't cost your firm? Of course it costs your firm. There's a nice thesis of Milton Friedman called the permanent income hypothesis, which says people are not lab rats. We look not just this year, we look down at the course of our life, and we see what a government is spending now, and we adjust our consumption accordingly. If we see the government's overspending now, well, then later we know the taxes are going to come, so maybe we save a little more. We're not reacting minute to minute. We have a lot of wisdom about, a lot of learning, some of it bitter, about what happens in an economy, and we adjust all our behavior towards it. So it would be nice if it were a free lunch that small businesses didn't pay for health care, but it's not a free lunch. Small businesses will co-carry that later. And the first question involved, or did you want to?
We'll move on.
Okay, we'll move on.
Here's a really good one. What could President Hoover have done to stop or reverse the credit collapse in the 30 to 32 period?
That was hard. The 30, lawyers argue the best case for it was awful, it was an act of God, is 30, 32. There were so many factors, including the UK going off the gold standard, gold rushing in and out of the country. Here are three things Hoover could have done. He could have not signed the bad tariff Smoot-Hawley. Trade wasn't that big a part of our economy at that time, but it was real. And what it did was send a signal to everyone else, every other country, which is also in trouble, that we didn't care about them. We didn't want their cars. We didn't want anything. So they retaliated and made prices higher for us. And also, more importantly, the Smoot-Hawley tariff caused instability in Europe because the Europeans saw we didn't care. Hjalmar Schacht, the German central banker, his middle name is Horace Greeley. He didn't have to be a Nazi. He lived in America. He was very sophisticated. He could be sitting right here. Became a Nazi. Why? Because the U.S. and England just didn't care how bad it was in Germany. And, the whole Weimar period. And the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which Hoover signed, was part of that. Another factor you won't hear often, Davis-Bacon. That law, that's a Hoover law. Hoover believed in putting upward pressure on wages, notwithstanding whether or not their productivity gains. Davis-Bacon put upward pressure on labor costs, drove prevailing wage at a time when employers could ill afford to have upward pressure on wages. So what happened? They hired less. I don't know, a third one, I think, is just to signal the country that the government was going to take care of it. I very much believe, looking at the data, there's plenty of evidence that the economy would have come back by the mid-30s. It took a while, but by saying it's up to us and we'll do it and signaling that all governments should run the economy, he laid the groundwork for a lot of intervention that did impede recovery later.
Good. We've got two people interested in restructuring the tax code and want your opinion on that. One is to replace federal income taxes with a consumption tax, and the other, a variation, is all the payroll taxes, Social Security and Medicare, for a national sales tax on everything.
There's not, I mean, if you had a true economist standing up here, they love consumption taxes because it leaves the business the money to invest. It's wonderful. There's nothing wrong with it. Technically, it works. You heard Herman Cain getting into that with Romney last night. The only problem with a sales tax, well, there are two problems. The first is, will they implement it and get rid of the income taxes they promise? So it's a problem of political trust. And I think, am I right? Michelle Bachmann tried to get at that. I don't know how she tried to get at it, but she's right, because what you're afraid of is a bait and switch where we add that national sales tax in the name of austerity, biting the bullet, pulling in our belt, being men, taking the pain, blah, blah, and we keep the income tax. It's very possible. That's the problem with the national sales tax or consumption tax idea. That is inherent in some of the plans, as attractive as it is and as well as it works in economic theory. Again, as in what my talk, human nature, what we know about human nature, is important too, no matter what's good in economics textbook. The second aspect of a sales tax is, if you've ever noticed, there's something scuzzy about Europe. Have you ever noticed Europe's a little scuzzy? Scuzzy about the people? What's scuzzy about Europe? Well, what's scuzzy about the Europe is about Europe is that their VATs are real high, right? 20 almost, maybe. Can't always see it because it's not, the tax isn't written on there, right? It doesn't say the share of something that's taxed. But when you buy something big in Europe, like a car, you know, the VAT, that's their sales tax basically. Well, it's very high, 15, 20. And pretty soon, what Herman said notwithstanding, you do, when you go to a sales tax system, and get rid of an income tax, if we do, start to get to rates of 15 to 20. What happens to people when they confront a 15 to 20 rate? They cheat. Sorry. We know that. They cheat. They buy it online from a place. I once visited a stereo company that was based on the principle that it could sell without sales tax because the jurisprudence over Nexus had not been clarified. It was in a state with no tax. So it was able to sell, and who was going to intervene, and how were the state authorities going to capture that revenue with their use tax? Well, it was going to be hard. And they sold big things that cost $2,000 or $3,000 where the sales tax mattered, even if it was only 5%. That's the problem with the VAT culture. And you look at all the VATs, which is the more economically sensible, and you'll see two things. One is they didn't get rid of the income tax, whatever they said, so they had both, and they were just all together a more heavily taxed culture. And two, they're scuzzy because people start to lie. And we care a lot about our civics. We don't lie. We actually lie less than other countries. We like that about ourselves. Our IRS is a model. The Foreign Bureau, you know, Revenue Bureaus come here and study the IRS because the compliance in the United States is so fabulous. People do what they say. They don't lie. Oh, my God, why? Well, I think one reason is we never confront them with that awful 20% or 15 or 18% bill on the quite that way. And I'm averse to it for reasons of civics.
Thank you. We've got a question that wants to ask you about the United States compared to the rest of the world and how we promote the development of entrepreneurs versus other countries around the world.
Well, if you had, you know, one of the candidates here, they talked about the corporate tax, it's too high. That's a problem. Relative to the others. At the Bush Institute, I think we're going to have a big tax conference about that. But that's the number one We have a lot of advantages. Education, I think we need more education, especially I'm more for the October sky kind of education, the education that we had, GI Bill, and things around the missile gap, where we have a premium on qualifying in areas, engineering, accounting, nursing, like that, and less emphasis in terms of education on younger grades. We've tried that. We all care about it desperately. It's not clear whether our policies work. So given that we're not clear on how to fix the younger grades, it's best to have what President Obama called a race to the top. I have certain aspects of the race to the top policy. I don't like the actual policy that goes under that name, but race to the top is a good idea for kids. And we need more of a race to the top at all levels where kids are rewarded for performance one way or the other by qualification. And then how do we help them be rewarded for performance? That would give us more advantage against the world, that not just Singapore math, but also high school and college race to the top and support for qualification.
Here's a narrative question. I'm going to try and get this to you because I think it's the author is getting it a really good question. And it starts out saying, a story is always part of another story. And then says, making sure, your quote, he says, making sure it is not too bad. When is too bad too bad? And finally, how do you convince the younger generation that the situation is not, quote, too bad, given the financial and economic tightening to the left and to the right of that generation?
Well, I was just – thank you for that question. I like the younger generation a lot, and I have a lot of faith in them. And one thing I was looking at with jobs, because I was writing a column about him, was all the stuff – I mean, the 70s were kind of a junky decade. Well, inflation, right? Strange laws like the NRA from the Nixon administration at the time of the closing of the gold window. Oh, my gosh, more inflation. Eventually, interest rates went so high. And there are people in this room who bought a house or got a mortgage in the early 80s. And remember what we had to do to get those interest rates down and how much less house you bought and how hard it was to sell a house when the interest rates were You tell our young people this 10, 15, right, prime towards 20. You recall those years. And yet, Mr. Jobs, somehow, and all that bad rule from ERISA I just told you about that said no to all venture capital, and yet he did that in his garage. Why did he do it? What made him do it? I think that they know that when you've had a couple of bad years, it's to your advantage. It's to their advantage to enter a down scene because the amount they can grow is so much. Right? If you start at a very low base, growth is very impressive. So what we regret as parents maybe, how hard is it going to be for us to make up these lost years? Probably impossible. For them, they're starting at a low base, so they have enormous potential for growth. Risky environments, uncertain environments of the sort I just described that we dislike are the environments where those entrepreneurs do especially well. Frank Knight of the University of Chicago wrote a paper in 1921 about uncertainty. And it didn't say uncertainty was bad. It said uncertainty is great for entrepreneurs because then the risks they take may pay off because nobody else will take the risk, and they may get large profits. So a down situation for everyone else is an ideal time to enter for the younger people, and thank goodness for that, given all the burdens they have to carry vis-a-vis entitlements and tax. They didn't lose money the way we did. They all, so some of them will make money. They didn't get burned the way this room did. They're more optimistic, and they may lead us out of it.
Let's give our speaker a round of applause. Tremendous. Thank you. Thank you very much for those remarks. Thank you for the great ending remark about the optimism for the future. As a former holder of a 24% car payment in that period, and ecstatic at a 12% contract for deed to buy a house at how cheap it was. This was a bad flashback for some of us. But the point about the future, the point about entrepreneurs is a great place for us to end. And for, in fact, those of you who want to hear this again, It will be on WFYI, 90.1 on Monday, November 7th at 1 in the afternoon, and it is available for those of you who won't make that for download off WFYI.org. We want to thank once again our sponsor, the Liberty Fund, and our lunch sponsor, UIndy, for making this afternoon possible. We want to thank, as we always do, the staff of the Convention Center for serving us so effectively. And I want to encourage you to join us again next month on Monday, November 21st, for a presentation from Robert Haas, the President of the Council on Foreign Relations. Of course, tickets are available. Bring your friends, and you can reach us on the web at economicclubofindiana.com. And thanks again. Please, let's give another round of applause for Amity Shale.
You've been listening to writer Amity Shlaes, our second speaker in the 2011-2012 Economic Club of Indiana series. Next month, our scheduled speaker is Richard Haas, president of the Independent Council on Foreign Relations and former government policy advisor. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Alseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.